I want us to dive into the Gospel of Mark. And like I said, today we're going to be in Mark chapter 8. And what we're going to discover today is kind of like Christianity 101. Now, I know when you hear the term Christianity 101, you think of like the basics of Christianity. It's the real simple stuff, the real easy stuff. But actually, Christianity 101, the basics of Christianity is pretty difficult, as we're going to see here in just a minute. Jesus kind of lays out what it means to be his follower and what's required of those of us who are his followers. And it's, even though it's kind of the basic stuff, it's pretty challenging. It's pretty difficult. And I'll just give you that warning right up front. But it's something that we have to talk about because it's so important to us if we're going to be followers of Jesus. So what we're going to do is we're going to watch Mark chapter 8, and I want you to do what I've been asking you to do throughout this series. I want you to kind of make some notes, kind of outline what goes on in this chapter, because there's some really, really great and important stuff that happens in Mark chapter 8. And then we'll come back after we watch this and we'll talk about a little section of it. So you can go ahead and play that, Clay. So let's kind of talk through what happens, because there's so much great stuff that happens in chapter 8 here. We're going to kind of outline it, but it begins with the story where Jesus feeds the 4,000. Now, this is different from the story where he feeds the 5,000. But I love this story because it starts off by saying Jesus saw the crowds and he had compassion on them. And so many times we're like, there's no way because of what I've done or what I've been through or what's going on in my life that God would look at me with compassion. But Jesus seems to always look at crowds and people with compassion, which I think is fascinating. Then what happens next is there's this interesting interchange with the Pharisees, and they want a sign, and then Jesus is leaving and he says to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod, which a lot of us are like, what does that mean? Well, basically what he's talking about there is to beware of legalism. And beware of being power hungry, because the Pharisees were defined by legalism and Herod was defined by his hunger for power. And he's like, beware of that stuff. That's not where it's at. And then there's that really weird healing. This may be the weirdest healing in the entire Bible right here, you know, where Jesus heals the blind man by spitting on his eyes. I don't want to be that guy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he doesn't seem to do that other times. Why does he do that this time? It doesn't tell us, but he does. That's what he does. And then there's Peter's confession of the Messiah. And then Jesus kind of predicts his death and his resurrection. And then the chapter ends with the cost of following Jesus. Now, like I said, I love chapter 8 because there's so much great stuff in it. But I want us to look at the last three sections of that outline. And the reason why I want us to look at three sections today is because all of these go together. And what they do is they paint a picture for us of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, like what's required in being a follower of Jesus. And for those of us who are followers of Jesus, this is a great mirror for us to kind of evaluate how we're doing. How are we actually doing what it is that we're supposed to be doing as followers of Jesus? So if you have your Bible, I'd love for you to open up to Mark chapter 8. We're going to start in verse 27. If you don't have a Bible, there's some in the seat in front of you. You can pull it up on your phone on the YouVersion Bible app. There's a number of places for you to take notes on there under the events section. But it begins, like I said, in verse 27 this way. It says, Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, who do people say that I am? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. Now, first off, let's stop there for a minute, because Jesus kind of is baiting the disciples with a question. What's the word on the street about me? Like, what are people saying about me? Who do other people say that I am? And there's a lot of answers to that question. Some say you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead, because remember, he was beheaded. Some say you're Elijah or one of the prophets, all these things. But Jesus, the truth of the matter was, Jesus wasn't interested in the answer to this question. Jesus only asked this question to set up his second question. And that's this. Look at verse 29. He says, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Peter answered, you are the Messiah. And then Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Like, what Jesus really wanted to know is, after the disciples had been following him for a year or so, they'd kind of been trekking along behind him. They'd seen him do all these miracles. They'd experienced so much. They'd heard him teach some things. Jesus wanted to know what their opinion was of him. Who did they think he was? Who do you say that I am? And Peter, the one who's always the first one to open his mouth, is the first one to open his mouth here. And he says that, Jesus, you're the Messiah. If you read this out of the Gospel of Matthew, he has the phrase, you're the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, I want to stop there because this is really, really important, and I'd hate for us to miss it. This actually, I think, might be the most important passage in the entire Gospel of Mark. And the reason why I think this is the most important passage in the entire Gospel of Mark is because the foundation of Christianity is based on what Peter says. The foundation of Christianity is the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, the chosen one who is prophesied and promised and who came to fulfill those prophecies and those promises and to be a sacrifice for the sins of the world. That is the foundation of Christianity, right? That's what our faith is built on, that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. Christ, if you ever wonder what the word Christ, is that like Jesus' last name? No, Christ is not Jesus' last name. It's also not a cuss word. But Christ is actually the Greek word for Messiah, which is the Hebrew word. They're just different from different languages. Messiah is Hebrew. Christ comes from the Greek, and it just means chosen one, the one they've been looking for, the one they had been prophesied and promised. And Peter declares that is who Jesus is, that he is the Messiah. And then Jesus says something weird. He says something that he always says, don't tell anybody. Which is weird, right? Because, you know, you would think that I'm the Messiah. Would you go tell everybody that I'm the Messiah? But he's not done with what he needs to do yet, and so he doesn't want any more word about him to get out than is already out. But I want, before we move on to the next few verses, I want you to focus on the question that Jesus asked the disciples. And imagine for a minute, what if Jesus were looking at you straight in the eye, and he were to ask you, who do you say that I am? How would you answer that question? If Jesus were to ask you, who do you say that I am? How would you answer Jesus? See, I think that might be the most important question we could ever answer. Because the figuring out what to do with Jesus is really the most important decision that any of us will ever make. And Peter speaks up and says, you're the Messiah, you're the Son of God, you're the one we've been looking for, but what about you? Who do you say that Jesus is? See, at the foundation of being a Christian is the acknowledgement that Jesus actually is the Messiah. That he's just not some really good teacher, that he's not somebody that said some really nice things, that he's not just some mythical figure that we can look to as an example and model our lives after. No, the foundation of Christianity is the fact that Jesus is the Messiah, the chosen one, the one sent from God to save the world from their sins. Now, here's what I've found to be true in my experience in church world, because I've been in church world my whole life. A lot of people's faith stops there. Like, we make a decision sometime in vacation Bible school, or we walked an aisle some church service some long time ago, and we acknowledge that we believe that Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of God, and that's all our faith is about. And it would be fine if Jesus kind of stopped and said, this is what it's all about. Just believe that I'm the Messiah and everything's good. But like I said, these sections go together. You can't pull them apart. So let's look at what he says next, because he says something else very important about himself. In verse 31, he says, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man, that was a phrase that Jesus used to describe himself, the Son of Man, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Now we, if you've grown up in church especially, we're familiar with this whole idea that Jesus came to die for the sins of the world, and then after 3 days, he rose from the dead. But remember, we're looking at this from kind of a Jewish perspective or a first century perspective for just a minute, and when you look at it from that perspective, what Jesus is saying here is pretty radical. And the reason why it's pretty radical is because Jesus is very clear that he's going to suffer, that he's going to be rejected by those who are in authority, he's going to be killed, and then after 3 days, he's going to rise from the dead. Now, the reason why that's so controversial is because that is contrary to what anybody thought about the Messiah. Nobody thought the Messiah was going to be rejected, that the Messiah was going to be killed, and that the Messiah was going to rise from the dead. They didn't think that at all. That went against their preconceived notions of a Messiah. And so Peter does what Peter does. He opens his mouth and rebukes Jesus, saying, you got it all wrong. Look at verse 32. It says he spoke plainly about this, which is Mark's way of telling us Jesus was really, really clear that he was going to be rejected, that he was going to be killed, and that he was going to rise from the dead. And so Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Like, how much courage does it take to rebuke Jesus? I mean, it's pretty crazy. The guy just fed 4,000 people with a few loaves of bread and healed a blind guy's eyes by spitting on him, and you're going to rebuke him? I mean, come on. Peter's not the smartest guy. But Peter, the reason why Peter rebukes Jesus is because Peter and the other disciples and really all of the Jews at this time had this idea in their head about who the Messiah was and what the Messiah was supposed to do. And the Messiah wasn't somebody who would suffer or be rejected or be killed. See, when they thought of the Messiah, you know what they thought of? They thought of this political ruler who would come in and take over Israel, kick the Romans out, and return Israel to its glory days. That's what they were looking for. And then here Jesus shows up, says he is the Messiah, but guess what? Everything that you had in your mind about me is wrong. I'm about to be rejected. I'm about to be killed. To which Peter goes, that's not right. You don't know the story, Jesus. We've been talking about the Messiah for years and you've got it wrong. That's not what's supposed to happen with the Messiah. There's no way the Messiah can be rejected and killed. Get it right, Jesus. I mean, that's kind of what Peter's getting at. And so how does Jesus respond to Peter's rebuke with his own rebuke of Peter? And his rebuke's a little harsher. Verse 33, it says, but when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, like he wanted to make sure that the rest of the group was paying attention at this moment, because he knew that they were just as upset with what he said as Peter. They just weren't bold enough to say anything like Peter. Says he rebuked Peter, and look at his rebuke. Get behind me, Satan. Now, I don't know if you've ever been called Satan before, but it's never in a positive light, right? It's not like, how you doing, Satan? So glad to have you over. You know, it's not like that, right? And for Jesus to say, get behind me, Satan, like Jesus is the guy who, if you remember from earlier on in the Gospel of Mark, actually had an encounter with Satan in the wilderness where Satan showed up to kind of tempt him and to kind of get him off track. Jesus knew exactly who Satan was. So he wasn't just throwing this word out there lightly. He was making a point. And the point was this, that Peter was saying something that was in complete contradiction to what God had in mind, which is what he says next. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. See, Jesus wanted to clear up this misperception that Peter and the disciples and the rest of the Jews and maybe even some of us have of who he is. That Jesus did not come to be a political ruler who was going to come and kick the Romans out and that was going to return Israel to its glory days. No, Jesus was going to be what Isaiah calls a suffering servant. He came as the Messiah to die for the sins of the world and to come back to life. And so he looks at Peter and it's like, you've got it all wrong. In fact, Peter, not only do you have it on wrong, but you know, Satan, we've kind of talked about Satan before, Peter, you and Satan are like on the same page in the way you're thinking about me. And you're just wrong. And so what he does is says this great phrase, you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. The reason why that phrase jumps out at me is because I think that there are so many times for me, and probably for you too, that you have in mind human concerns over the concerns of God. Think about it. Have you ever thought about what God's concerned about? God's concerned about people who are far away from him, right? Are we? God's concerned that his kingdom would come. That is, his rule and his reign would take root in every heart of every human who lives on this planet. That's what God's concerned about. Are we? God's concerned with his agenda and his way of doing things. Are we? See, at the root of being a Christian is laying aside our agendas and our desires and our concerns and replacing them with God's concerns and God's desires and God's agenda. And Jesus wanted to be clear right here to these disciples who were a little confused, and he wants to be clear to you and me, who I think are often confused, that we need to have in mind his concerns. And his concerns are different. And he goes on to kind of give a clear picture to the disciples and to us about what being a follower of Jesus should really look like. And what Jesus says here is actually difficult. It's hard, because look at what he says in verse 34. You want to know what it looks like to follow him? Then he called the crowd along, crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation," in other words, if anyone is ashamed of how I am going to live out what it means to be the disciple, if you're ashamed of that, as one who's going to be killed and rejected and rise from the dead, then the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. This list that Jesus has of these things in this passage are really characteristics that should define our following of him. And we're going to put it up on the screen, just listing out those kind of things about what's required for those of us who are his disciples. First thing he talks about, he says to deny yourself. To deny yourself, that is to lay aside what you want, to lay aside your agenda and your wishes, to deny yourself. Now, let's just be really, really honest. We're not all that good at denying ourselves, right? You know how I know that? How many of you have a belly? You know, it's like we're just not, you know what I'm saying? We're not good at denying ourselves. This is a struggle, especially in our culture. Mark Batterson says that one of the best ways that we can practice, put into practice what Jesus says here is by fasting, by intentionally denying ourselves of food or intentionally denying ourselves of some things. He says to deny yourself. You want to know what it means to be a follower of his? The first thing you need to know is you need to be in the habit of denying yourself. Are you? Then he says to take up your cross. Now for Jesus, we know what that meant, right? Like we know how the story ends, that Jesus literally took up his cross, that he carried his cross to the place called the skull and they crucified him there and he died. But what does it mean for you and me to take up our cross? I heard somebody say that taking up your cross is doing what God has called and created you to do as a unique follower of his. That is that God has a unique calling for each of our lives. And that when you take up your cross, that you are accomplishing that calling, that you're doing what it is that he has called you to do. Are you doing what it is that he has called you to do? Are you taking up your cross? Interestingly, he doesn't say take up my cross. He says take up your cross. And then he says this, follow me, follow him. And we've talked about what it means to follow Jesus. Following Jesus means that we become like him, that we model our life after his life, that we live the life that Jesus would live if he were living our life. And then he talks about losing your life. The way he talks about it is it shouldn't even be a surprise to us, right? That we should just be in the habit of losing our lives. And when I think about how that works out in our culture, specifically as American Christians, instead of standing up for our rights, maybe sometimes we need to intentionally submit ourselves to think about others, that we need to lay down our rights for the good of others, that we need to step back instead of putting ourselves in the spotlight, let somebody else be in the spotlight, but to lose our life. And then he ends with this whole idea of not being ashamed of him. And what that's talking about, like I already said, is really not being ashamed of how he's the Messiah, that he is the one who was rejected and was crucified and who rose from the dead, that we're not ashamed of that, that maybe he, even though he doesn't do things the way the world does them or that other people think they should be done, that Jesus is who he is and we take him on his terms. So I want you to look at that list for just a minute. Deny yourself, take up your cross, follow him, lose your life, not be ashamed of Jesus. And I want you to ask yourself this question. Is your Christianity, now if you're not a Christian, you don't have to worry about this, but if you are, you call yourself a Christian, is your Christianity defined and described by those characteristics. When you think about your Christianity, I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian since I was five. I think I was a Christian before five, but five is when I prayed a prayer, right? You know, that's my thing. I've been a Christian for a really long time, 40 years or more. Is my Christianity defined and described by those terms? You call yourself a Christian. Is your Christianity defined and described by what Jesus says should define and describe us as his followers? Because remember how he started verse 34? Whoever wants to be my disciple, to which you're like, I want to be your disciple, Jesus. That's why I'm here, right? Well, here it is. Deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. Lose your life, not be ashamed of Jesus. Those things should define us and describe our lives. So here's what I want you to do. I really only have two things I want you to do in light of what we're looking at here. Well, maybe three things, but one of them. First, if you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, this is kind of a warning. You may not want to be. You ever thought about that? Like Jesus is saying, the cost of following me might be too much, so think about it before you go all in. I will say it's the best decision you could ever make, but you need to think about it first, Jesus says. But for those of us who are followers of Jesus, I really have two things I think we should do, or that I want you to do. First, I want you to evaluate your Christianity in light of these requirements. How do you deny yourself? How do you take up your cross? How are you following him and becoming like him? How do you lose your life? How are you not being ashamed of Jesus? See, I think there are times when we need to step back and we need to kind of do some self-assessment, some evaluation to see how we're doing. And most of us don't want to do that. You know why? Because we're not really sure we're going to like what we discover. Like, we just want to keep going with the way things are going, and we don't want to, like, point out things that we need to work on, right? Because then, you know what? Doggone it, we got to work on those things. But can I tell you what I want for you and for me, for those of us who call Hub City Church our church family? I want us to look like this. That's what I want to describe our lives and to define our lives. And when I evaluate my life, I know that I fall short so often. But that's my goal. That's what I'm shooting for, and I hope that for you. So that's the first thing I want you to do an evaluation. Second thing, I want you to memorize what Jesus says in verse 34. Can you put verse 34 up there again, Clay? Where he says, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And the reason why I want you to memorize this, it's because I want it to sink so far deep inside of your soul and your being that you can't get away from it. And that it becomes a regular prayer of yours. God, help me to know how to deny myself today. Help me to take up my cross and follow you today. God, help me to become like you today. That as we memorize this, it becomes a part of us, a part of who we are as his followers. That when others look at us, they might describe us like Jesus says we should be described. Let's pray. Before I pray, I want to give you an opportunity to pray. I want to just give you some space to maybe confess that your Christianity has not been defined by these words. Maybe you need to just take a little bit of time to say, God, please forgive me. And maybe for you, you need to take this opportunity to just commit to him, that you're going to deny yourself, that you're going to take up your cross, that you're going to follow him. I just want to give you an opportunity, just a few seconds, for you to have a conversation with God. Jesus, I want to thank you for what we discover in these verses, that you are the Messiah. And we acknowledge that. I acknowledge that this morning. But you're not You're a different kind of Messiah. You're a Messiah who came to be rejected and to be crucified and to rise from the dead. And we believe that. I believe that. That happened. And Lord Jesus, I want to be your follower, and I know that many of us in this room, we also want to be your followers. We want to be your disciples. But when we look at this list of the things that are required of us or that should characterize us, man, it just is kind of hard. We are not good at denying ourselves. We are not really interested in taking up our cross. And even though we say we want to follow you, we chase after all kinds of other things instead of you. And I ask that you would please forgive us for that. And that you would draw us back to yourself. And that these characteristics would really define us. Lord, give us the courage to do what it is that you are calling us to do this morning. You know what that is better than I know. Just speak to our hearts and our minds. Thanks for loving us in spite of our sinfulness and our just doing our own thing, God. Continue to be patient with us and shape us to become more and more like Jesus. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.